Thank you for coming. Now, can you hear me? Probably, yep. Can you hear me down back? Yes.
I'm a little bit.
Okay. This is my first guest speech I've ever done. And when I thought, what will I do? I came here last year. I came in here, not so much incognito, but I was spying on you all to see what sort of things you wanted. And I went to Glenda Lark's speech, and she took the tack of not just talking about her books, but also the other things she'd done in her life. So I thought, I'll do that too, because I worked as an illustrator, and I have had relationship with publishing companies before that you might find interesting. And also, I realised that when I was putting this together, that really it's the answers to questions I'm asked all the time, except with pictures. And I had great fun putting pictures together, because I thought, I don't normally get the chance to show people this sort of thing. I'll talk about how I've worked as an illustrator, and I don't get a chance to show people the actual illustrations. So here's a little potted history of me. First picture. And I when I went looking for stuff, I went looking for these little books that I'd made, the first books I ever wrote. I made them when I was probably 8 or 9 or something. And they were Dora the Dormouse's adventures. But I could not find them. And instead, when I was looking, I found my old school reports. And I thought, I can't start a presentation with school reports. How embarrassing.
Why not?
Depends what's on them.
They're really funny, and they actually answered a question that I kind of half knew the answer to, but they sort of, they're proof. So the first one's this one. Trudy is very pleasant, but she daydreams too much. This is the next year.
Creative role.
Her written and artworks show imagination and diligence. And I thought, what happened between those 2 years? Well, I know what happened. It was the year of Star Wars. It's actually not the year of the first Star Wars movie, the second Star Wars movie, which is one with all the angst. And I was so inspired by this movie, I thought, I am going to be a movie maker. I'm going to make movies, and they're going to be science fiction, and they're going to be really cool. And so, of course, I told every adult, you know, at that age, adults are always saying to me, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I say, I want to make movies. And they go, that's a hard thing to get into, you know. But in the meantime, why don't you write your ideas down? So I did. I was writing really, really bad stories, that sort of thing you write at 8 and 12 and 14 and 16 and 19. But I didn't necessarily want to be a writer at that point. I was just writing my ideas, and I was doing lots of drawings as well. And, when I got to about 14, the Lord of the Rings radio show came on, and it went for about 52 weeks. And by about the 6th week, I had already read the whole thing. Like, I listened to it and went, I have to read this, and I went out and read it. And then I followed the rest of it by, along with the book, as the radio show happened, so I could see what bits were missing and stuff like that. And then I decided I was going to be a writer, and I wanted to write something as great as this, but maybe not take 12 years to do it. That is kind of ironic now. Yes, the 7-year overnight success. At that age, I'm going to digress a little bit, because this next bit I quite love. I also used to draw maps. I love drawing maps. You know, you just wiggly shapes, throwing little pictures of trees, little lakes and stuff. It had absolutely nothing to do with proper geography or anything like that. Kids, so here's one nice early one. You notice there's that on the
top.
Yeah. And the continent of Thai. At least it didn't have, like, you know, 50 characters long with all those little funny omelets and stuff all over. Starting with Z. But you notice there's that bay on the top left corner, and there's that island down the bottom right, and there's a lake in the middle. And so I seem to have this thing where I just kept repeating. There were some things that just kept repeating. So here's another map. What I love about this one is it's got Water Lake, as if it would have anything else. But by then I was getting an idea of how maps are drawn. You know, this is sort of more than just your little, you know, triangular witch's hat kind of mountains and stuff like that. Following on. When I got to year 11, I had did pottery, and I thought, okay, this is a great way to try and get some idea of the way that the continental plates might have affected the evolution of this. So I got bits of clay, and I threw them down, and I pushed them up against each other as if they were folding plates, and I carved the bays out, and where it all bunched up, I made them into little peaks of mountains. That's a plaster cast of that map. And by then I already had a story that's connected to this particular one. So it's, again, if you see, it's in reverse. It's got the bay and the island down there. But I think by then the lake in the middle had disappeared. This turned into, this is the story that I wrote for the second series, Age of the Five. And that's the working map. So by then I had realised that the sense of scale here was wrong. If I wanted to have a small bay, it needed to be a lot smaller. This is a continent-sized group of islands. So the bay got a lot smaller, and the island down the bottom actually ends up connected by an isthmus. And I'm sure I only put isthmus in because I thought it was such a cool word. But it also turned out to be a great military sort of strategic point to have armies make. So this is what I worked on as I did the book, and I would add country names and city locations and stuff like that as I went along. And then, of course, the final map. Now, I did a lot of cartography as I got older, which is sort of ironic, for several reasons. It turned out, if you look back far enough in my ancestry on one side, there was a cartographer to the king in Ireland several centuries ago. So when I was working at Lonely Planet, I was utterly, utterly sick of mapping. I thought, I'm doomed. It's in the genes, I'm always going to do this. But my philosophy with maps is, first of all, I look at the fantasy books and I go, these are really unrealistic maps. They don't look like any kind of geological formation that would logically have come to be. And I had this thing where, at first, I really wanted the maps to be very accurate and, you know, get the point where you want to draw topographic maps and things like that to make them really good maps. And then you realise that, no, actually, what I'd rather have is maps that look like the maps of the time, that the technological era that the books are set in. So this is set in a classical era, and I looked at old maps from that. Actually, they don't actually have any maps from that time, but they have maps that are copied from that time, and looked at the way they drew them. And they weren't necessarily to scale, and they often made it look like that continent was that planet, and there's a lot of distortion and things like that. So I went back to drawing, obviously, a little witch's hats for mountains and things like that. So it's almost like a full circle. Anyway, and the other good thing is, as I will touch on later, even though I'm an illustrator, I never got a chance to do my own covers. Publishers are not particularly keen on authors doing their own covers. This is the one way I could actually get an illustration into my books. So, little digression. Okay. When I was a teenager and I decided I wanted to be a writer, I went and got a book from the library called Writing for the Fun of It, something like that. I've been trying to track this book down and I can't find it. But it basically said, writing's a dog's game, you know, you do all this work, and you get paid very little for it, and when you finally see the book in a bookshop, it's face down with a dead fly on top of it. I thought I'd care.
With a dead fly.
With a dead fly on top of it. I particularly remember that line. I thought, okay, I'm going to need to do something else for my day job. So I concentrated on the art side of said I was good at art and writing. So I thought, okay, the art side is, and particularly graphics. When it came to the art stuff, I was ruthless that they had to make money for me. I wasn't going to be a starving artist in a garret. So I did. That's sort of the way my career went, my education went. I was always focusing on art. I eventually got into the Melbourne College of Decoration. Melbourne College of Decoration doesn't exist anymore, it's part of the Royal Melbourne Institute of Technology. But it was all about window dressing and graphic design and photography and perspective drawing. So I could do anything from work for an architect to work for a publisher through to work for a graphic design studio. We did exhibition designs and things like that. And this is a little bit of my work. I'm just going to show you a small amount of it. So this is obviously Australia Post, mythical, you know, obviously didn't do any work for Australia Post, but some of the sort of things we do. Fletcher Jones. See the fashions of the time. I think it was my dad's suit. So this is window dressing. And then you start to see something creepy in here. You know, she's holding a sword. This is a Lindcraft style, or a, you know, Clegg's style, where they get swathes of material and you've got to make clothing out of it without actually making clothing out of it. And then Peyton's Bluebell, funnier than knitting. And she's wearing a cloak, see? Yeah, I got the fantasy into that one as well. And then I went, because we had to gather our own materials, there was a limited amount of stuff that the college could give you to make these, to put these displays together. So we had to go out and get our own, and I thought, looked up publishing companies straight away in the phone book and realised that Allen and Unwin, who at the time were publishing all the Tolkien works, were in the city just down the road. So I rocked up to the office and said, oh, I'm a student and I need lots of publicity material to do all these displays with. And they went, see this door over there, just go in there. And I walked in and it was an absolute mess. It was all posters and mobiles and all this publicity stuff spread all over the floor, sometimes in rolls, sometimes just torn and on the floor. And I just dug through this pile of stuff and At home I have some pictures, publicity pictures for Lord of the Rings. I've got maps, I've got a poem, one of Bilbo's poems, framed on my walls now, because this, you know, there's only maybe one or two copies there that had come over, and they didn't have any shops that were interested in that stuff. So, this is some of the, and I didn't just grab stuff for the Lord of the Rings and Tolkien stuff, I also grabbed a few others. This was a great one, because it was very graphic-y sort of stuff that I could work with. We often, you know, this sort of thing in the middle up there, you'd make 3D out of 2D stuff and make it all sort of come out. But of course I had to do the Hobbit 30th anniversary. So that's the kind of stuff I did at TAFE. Unfortunately, it was really focused on window dressing, that course. And I wasn't that interested in window dressing, and they organised for us 2 separate weeks of work experience at Myers. And the first week, by the end of the first week, I was absolutely sure I did not want to be a window dresser. Absolutely convinced of it. And I swear, I still get chills if I hear Thomas the Tank Engine's, you know, theme song. So I said to the managers of the school, I'm not sure what they called them, is there any way I can go somewhere else, you know, instead of doing another week at Myers? Because I think I'll just sit my own wrist so I have to go back to Myers. And I said, if you can find somewhere, you know, and it's related to what we do, then sure. Well, as it turned out, my boyfriend's mother's tennis friend's son worked at Lonely Planet Publications.
Close relation.
Yeah. And she said, oh, they're really open to having work experience. It's a publishing company. Well, books. This is good. So I rang them up and I said, oh, we don't even need to take a name. Just rock up. You know, work experience students come in all the time off the street, so... Lonely Planet was only about 20 people in those days, and they were all laid-back hippies, and I was a very conservative teenager. I rocked up and there's this display and there's all these Buddhas and stuff, you know, hippie things all over, and I'm like, God, oh my God, I got myself work experience in some sort of new age crap place. Oh, what am I going to do? You know, within the end of the week I had a job. I realised, you know, it's all just travel stuff, and while they were laid-back hippies, they were really cool people. Yeah, this is where I started to get corrupted. Really nice place to work. They basically looked at me, you can draw. We want you to work for us. And so I got hired pretty much on my drawing skills, but there was also the cartography, as I've mentioned. They were going to teach me how to draw maps properly, and also design work, so I was laying out the books. Yeah. This Africa of the Shoestring is the first book I ever worked on. In those days, you would have a piece of paper that was kind of shiny and it had all these blue lines on it, and that was drawn up in the format of the book. And this great big massive stinky machine would produce strips of photographic paper with the text on it. It was a big typesetting machine. And you had to cut out the text into strips and wax the back of it and then position it and cut and position and cut. And if you had to change the position of like the illustration that you were working around, it was fitted very carefully back together again and rub down the wax strips and stuff like that. Now, Africa on the Shoestring had 1,150 running heads. The running heads are the numbers. I know this because I had to put them all down individually, and it's not something you forget. It took about 3 days. And then they'd fall off again. It's just one wouldn't be quite... So because every time some of the editors would flick through, and you'd have, running head goes, this big, it's precious. The Quechuan phrase book there, it was a funny one, because in this process of the typesetting, particularly when it came to a cover, the designer would write down the text that they wanted and they'd give it to the editor and the editor would proof it. And then you'd give it to the typesetter and the typesetter would type it in and then it would come out and the editor would proof it. And then you'd stick it down, the art director would have a look and the managing director would have a look and then we'd go up to the printer. Somehow, despite all those checking, the H was left out of phrase book. So it was the question. Praise the questions.
Praise book.
And everyone, it started this sort of... We had this meeting with this blame game that started, and I just sat in the background and shook my hands. There's just no way we're going to work out whose fault this is, because there's so many steps in the process, and none of them worked. So they had to pulp like 10,000 books or something and redo it. So, yeah. Anyway, the islands of Australia's Great Barrier Reef. Now, I didn't actually do any design work in this, but I did the very first colour illustrations, and you'll see one coming up. And the Jerusalem book was one of the very last ones I actually worked on. That's when I went to the States where I was working on commission for them. And by then, everything was really, it was computerized, it was slick, absolutely everything except the drawing of the illustrations was done on computers. So there's a couple of illustrations I did. I just plucked out to show the sort of work that I did and why they're hiking. And here's the fish chart.
That is actually used as an example for Twisted Brush Pro.
Is that a TV show?
No, it's the that art program that I was using up there.
Oh.
The gentleman who does it, he actually has, he owns a copy of that, and he doesn't sell the images or anything,
yeah.
But he uses it as a demonstration on how you mask and cover and color something completely without covering another thing.
Okay. Well, I do know that a few years ago I was contacted by a company that said we want to use this in a film. And they just wanted, all they wanted to do was just have the camera go past somebody holding the book open. And they had to get Lonely Planet's permission and my permission, and practically permission of the cast, you know.
I swear it is that one.
Wow, that's interesting.
Because
they
didn't
ask me. they actually technically don't have to ask me permission because Lonely Planet owns all the rights of these illustrations. This is an example of the mapping. Now, it's really, really hard to see the detail on this, but this is the Africa book and the Jerusalem book. Now, Africa book. All of those maps were drawn by the author and on tracing paper. It's all his handwriting. So whenever we made a change, because the edition I was working on was not the first edition, so he would correct stuff. I would have to sit there and forge his handwriting. I got really good at it. And then you got this Jerusalem book, which is just so sophisticated. And everything's on computer. It's just so easy to change. And they could suddenly put so much more detail in and make it so much more accurate, and yet somehow it's never accurate when you're actually there. Okay. I got really, really tired of mapping, as I've mentioned before. And it also is the reason why my back is stuffed, because we had these big tablets, and you'd put maps underneath the tablet, and you'd be constantly tracing and looking up and down all day. And that's why my back muscles are completely stuffed. They probably did more nodding than anyone does in their lifetime in about 5 years. So I got really tired of it, and I started to get another job in a publishing company to spread myself around, and I went to Oxford University Press. Now, you could not find a publishing company more opposite to Lonely Planet. Lonely Planet still, even after 4 years, it had the cool, hippie, kind of relaxed thing. You know. I remember they once had a meeting where they said, we're going to show you how this whole thing works. You know, all transparent, pie charts, all stuff, and it was fantastic for me as a writer in that it showed you that more than 45% of that, you know, more than three quarters of that whole pie chart was printing costs. And then you got these little wedges. That's the little wedge the author gets, that little wedge the publisher gets, that's the little wedge that we actually donate to charity, that's the little wedge that the accountants, you know, all this sort of stuff. This little bit there was actually the publishing companies made money out of. Yeah, I think anyone who's a writer should actually get out there and educate themselves on how publishing companies really function. Because, you know, you look at the cover price and you think, oh, I'm only getting $2 per book. It's a good reason for it. So at Oxford, really, really boring. I remember that the second day I worked in the office, I came to the front door, and there's great big glass doors, and there's huge handles, and there's massive chains with this great big bolt. It was like, what are they expecting, World War III or something? And they were just very, very, you know, sort of conservative company. So I wandered around the building until I found this side door. Okay, so, you know, I could see stuff going in, so I went in, and I walked up to the first desk, and I picked the wrong person. And I went up and said, oh, hello, I'm new here. And I was going to say, when does this door open? When can I come in? And the guy just looked up and he went, you're from the department upstairs. And so I went, okay, what is it? There's a couple of people there who'd just been entrenched there forever and were just, you know, subhuman. oh, I'm serious. The rest of them tended to come in there and work for 1 or 2 years and then flee. And they only worked there for work experience because it's such a horrible place. But also quite unified. You know when you get a place where it feels like a war zone and everyone really unites behind each other? So I had a lot of good friends from that place. This is the general catalogue. Now, I had three parts of the company that I had to work for. Now, this is a promotional design part rather than making books. I wanted to get more into the graphic design thing. So this is trade. And then there was academic stream. Academic stream, I got exposed to so many fascinating books. Oxford University exists to provide a way to get the Oxford graduates' theses and projects and things published. So everything else, like the Oxford English Dictionary, everything else is to raise money to publish the most obscure, like mating habits of such and such butterfly. an entire book on it. Fascinating.
Gets to the bottom of it.
And then there was education. I only really had one brochure. That's the Australian Students' Dictionary. It's the only one brochure that I did that I had left. The fun thing is, the reason I put this selection up here is it illustrates two things. See that big shiny one in the middle? Quite often you do that, and then we'd all run out of money. So towards the end of the financial year, you'd start doing things like the crime stories one, which is entirely done on a photocopier. And I got to know every in and out on that photocopier. With two colours, black and white, both sides, concertina fold. And to get that to match up was a killer. But it worked really well.
Oh, yes.
The other thing it illustrates is, you see down the bottom left, there's a book called The Dictionary of Australian Underworld Slang. Now, like I said, I've encountered some fascinating books, and that's kind of a source of how slang evolves that led to me writing the slang in the Black Magician trilogy. Because there's a lot of things like, it's usually quite rude. You know, the prisoners would say, if they wanted to say a guy had a really nice ass, they'd say two apples in a bag, and then it would eventually become this word that just relates to that. And so when I was coming up with the slang in the book, I tried to use the same sort of evolution in my mind of where these words came from. And then on the bottom right, there's an invitation there that I did for an Australian Gay and Lesbian Writing Anthology, which also I end up using as research material for my first series. So it's really good to have a job where you can bounce off. Like, certainly Lonely Planet gave me a lot of insight into other cultures, and in particular the way outsiders view other cultures. So if you've got your characters visiting the country, it's quite different to when they're actually part of that country, the sorts of things that stand out. And also just gave me a whole lot of really wacky facts. This is also, as well, I got to use those skills that I had at the College of Decoration. Did lots of displays. This is a launch poster. I didn't actually do an entire exhibition stand, but I did lots of posters, like three-dimensional one-off posters to put up for the stand. All through this time, of course, I was writing, but I was never writing anything that I ever finished. I started calling myself the Leonardo da Vinci of writers, in that I'd start things and finish them. Not that I was really good. Then I became a freelancer. I got to 25, and I thought, I thought I'd have a book written by now, because when I was, of course, 14, I thought 25 was ancient. And of course, like everyone else at Oxford, I got to the point where I was there for 2 years, and I was really sick of it, and it was time to move on. And I thought, I can go get another job. And I actually went to a fascinating interview, I think it was with Penguin, and I'd done the resume was a book. I actually bound it and everything. And they said, we couldn't wait to meet you, because it's such a fantastic resume. And then by the end of the interview, we were both agreeing that I should be a freelancer. I said, you're too good for this place. You know, you're just going to be bored to death here. I said, oh, but I really want to work for Penguin. I've always wanted to work for Penguin. I said, no. So I became a freelancer with the idea that I would write part-time and work part-time. And I had this wonderful, glorious idea that in the mornings I'd work for half the day, and then when I was finished, I'd write for half the day. Because it never works like that, does it? When you're a freelancer, everyone hires you when they've got the last-minute job that they need done. And so you work insane hours for 2 weeks, and then you collapse, and then you get up and you write. And then after 2 weeks, you start getting really frantic because you don't have any work coming in, and you're wondering how you're going to pay next bills. So then you can't concentrate enough to write, and you go out and you start spruiking for more work. But it was really fun. I think I read somewhere that there's a 7-year itch with running a business, that it runs entirely on passion. And when you get to the point where you're just friends, it doesn't work anymore with the business. You don't have any reason to stay doing it. And fortunately for me, the writing took off about that stage. The other reason I thought it was time to actually write seriously was because I had an ending. I finally hit on an ending, which is the ending of the first series. A lot of people argue with me on that ending, but I still maintain it was the best ending for the books. Oh yeah, the sort of work I did as a freelancer. I love showing this because you think, illustration, that'll be a glamorous job. No, you're going to be doing things like tapeworms. And, you know, I love doing things like the babies. I did a lot of education work, so I did a lot of gribbly, gooey stuff. I also did a lot of maps, and it turned out that the mapping thing had really held me in good stead because there's a lot of illustrators out there and there's a lot of cartographers, but the cartographers tend to be geologists who are really highly trained and really, really expensive. And illustrators don't tend to do much in the way of maps. So I kind of had this niche. And so a lot of work I got was the maps, because I could do these pretty maps rather than really, you know, sort of very sort of austere kind of ones that geologists would produce. And so they went with things. This was the first one on the top left. Is from a book on, it was called The Medievals, and it was an educational book. And this is actually a picture of the plague spread. And you can't really see the detail, but there's this little spot in the middle, just above Italy. I think it's Milan, and like Milan at that time missed the plague, went all the way around it, but never went into the city. So I was finding out things even when I was working with these companies. The bottom right one was a book which showed spreads of the world, but what was happening simultaneously at the same time. And sometimes that would really just amaze you that in one part of the world something really awful was happening, but we were really quite civilised over here and inventing something over there. And then I was doing I ended up working for an awful lot of different publishing companies. So I've worked for most of these publishing companies in Australia as an illustrator or cartographer. The Antarctica one, I love that because it's a totally different sort of map. You don't often get maps with the latitude lines concentric. And the Tasmania one is for a book called Oyster, which was a foodie book. Wouldn't think you'd end up with maps in a foodie book, but map about oyster, a book about oysters shows you where all the oyster farms are. Okay. I also did children's education books as well for a certain age group. And they were great fun. I would get friends' kids to pose for me, and then they'd all get free books, and I'm famous. It's really good fun. So... At the same time, of course, I don't know, there's more. This is a book I did with Sarah Endicott. I don't know if anyone of you know Sarah Endicott. She's the editor of Orb, but she also works as a freelance editor, and she and I worked together on this book. And what I love about this one is it's actually one of the only major graphic design jobs I did as a freelancer. I tended to find that everyone went for the maps and the illustration work. If you look at the top right corner, there's a little picture of a horse up there. And if you flick the pages, it's amazing the things you can do when you're in charge of a job.
You can actually see the, very thinly on the upper left corner, you can see the horse on the other side.
Yeah. Okay, where am I?
Third.
In the story. Okay. So at the same time, I started writing the Black Magician trilogy. It took me about a year and a half to write the first draft, and I thought, I've got one book here. No, I don't. I've got two. No, I don't. I've got three. So I got to the point where I finished the intertwining of the work and the writing was in the first year I wrote the first half of that trilogy. And in the second 6 months, I wrote the second half because Lonely Planet had a cash flow crisis and there was no work. So I spent a lot of time doing a lot of neurotic fast writing, worrying about income. I polished up the first book, I sent it off to HarperCollins, and I never got a reply. And I suspect it might have got lost in the mail, because, you know, it's just nothing is not normal. You expect to get some sort of reject letter, even just a note, you know. At the same time that I started the business, everything all happened in 1995, like I started the business, I started writing part-time. I also went and did Dirk Strasser's used to run a course on writing science fiction and fantasy. Dirk Strasser is the editor of Aurealis magazine. Do you, anyone not know of Aurealis magazine? Who? And so by the end of the course, I'd volunteered to be the graphic designer of the magazine. Of course. I took the magazine from being this really quite small, little, badly designed thing to what I think was rather neat and tidy and legible. And yeah, after a while, I suppose the first thing that happened was I read Slush for a year. That's really good. Read Slush for a year if you're a writer. Don't read it for more than a year because I think it will destroy your soul. Reading it for a year teaches you an awful lot. And by the end of that, I thought, you know, I've only ever been interested in writing books, but I think I'll just give this short story writing thing a go. So I wrote a short story and I sent it in under a pseudonym because I thought, as the art director, I really don't want them sitting there at parties going, oh, that art director of ours, she can't write the statements. And I got a letter back saying, thank you, Sylvia. We would like your story, make a couple of alterations. I think they just wanted it a little bit shorter. And we'd love to publish it. I'm going to have to fess up now. So I let them know and they were. Well, Dirk actually was quite upset and he said that they had a rule that they'd established that you would get never do that, you would actually always admit that it was one of your stories. I said, no one told me that. And I still made it, it's different. They were all writers, they were already, you know, being published, that wasn't their very first story. So they published the story, and next thing you know, it was up for an Aurealis Award, and next thing you know, it was winning an Aurealis Award. So, well, okay, maybe I can write after all. So at about that time, Dirk had thought, okay, I'd like to, in fact, I'll show you the next. It is Aurealis. Number 16 is the first one I worked on. Number 23 on the other side is the one my short story was in. And number 19 is the one I did a cover for. And it's funny, I occasionally have people go, oh, it's really boring, that cover. It's actually an in-joke, because so many of the covers before number 19 had boomerangs on them, and no one yet had done a boomerang spaceship. Yes.
Did it always come back?
It's called Coming Home, I think. Yeah, it's called Coming Home.
Lost in space.
Yeah. That's the stand I did for the Aurealis team at WorldCon. I just love Michael Pryor's pose there. And that's at the point where Keith Stevenson and Sarah Creasy sort of came along, and Keith took over as head editor, and Sarah was the copy editor. It was like new blood. Brilliant. Yeah, so that's when the story came out, and then there was the... Oh, no. At the same time as all this, this is very exciting, I like it, I started doing illustrations for lots of science fiction and fantasy magazines. And this one was for Simon Brown's Dreaming Seas Beneath Cassandra, which I believe might have won a DITMA. But the actual illustration was nominated for a DITMA, and that's the first time I actually went to a con, because I'd never really heard of the DITMAs. And I thought, all right, I'll go along and see if I win. As it turned out, that only one person voted for me. And I was up against Mr. Squiggle. But it was a... It wasn't a great con, it was not very well organised, and there's reasons for that, which are quite understandable. And I only went for the day, and I went to the auction, and the auction actually is the reason I went back to cons, because Justin Aykroyd is a fantastic auctioneer, yes. And it was just hilarious and so much fun, and I bought a whole lot of stuff. Mm-hmm. And I thought, yeah, these con things are good, I'll give it a second chance. So, of course, then there was WorldCon. This is an illustration that was in Orb, Sarah Endicott's magazine. It's called for... Account Dracula by Adam Brown. Yeah. This one's from Andromeda Space Phase In Flight magazine. I did an issue for them. I did illustrations for all the stories in the issue. Kaladeshi Confident by Jeffrey Maloney. This is actually, was also nominated for DITMA jointly with that first one. It's the first illustration I did for any science fiction magazines. It's for Dusty Winona by Anthony Morris. And I actually contacted him and said, all through the story you mentioned this photo the guy's got of Winona Ryder. How about you photocopy it and send it to me and I'll include it in the picture. So it was always good to have that interaction. Finally, there's the illustration I did for my own short story, because when you're the art director of a magazine and your own stories in it, of course you've got to illustrate your own story. And I do try to match up, you know, if authors are illustrators, I gave them the opportunity to do illustrations for their own work, or in the case of Cat's Bucks, the illustrations for Rob Hood. People sort of appreciate that connection. Okay. So there's me accepting the Aurealis Award. Yay. Don't I look young? And, that award ceremony was in 2000, which was the same year that I got a fellowship to Verena Writers' Centre. Now, does anyone not know what Verena Writers' Centre is? It's a wonderful little place in the Blue Mountains. That had formerly been owned by Eleanor Dark and Mark Dark, who were literary writers, I believe. Literary? Yes. And they bequeathed the house to be a writer centre, and the wealth went towards financing writers staying there. And you stay there, and someone cleans for you, someone cooks. Oh, this Sheila the cook is fantastic. She's really good. And you get measure of weeks to spend working without any interruptions. There's no, well, there was no computer, no internet. There is now, but there's no TV. There's no, it's all quiet. It's all, and you get together with other writers, which is really stimulating. It gets you into. I had this amazing cathartic experience there, where I was the first, I suppose, adult genre writer, as in science fiction, fantasy. That's the thing, to stay there. And I was a bit worried because I'd heard about the snobbery of literary writers and whatnot. I got there was a non-fiction writer, a literary writer, and a poet, and I thought, I'm doomed. And then they had this amazing thing where we sat around the dinner table, and I said, all right, what we're going to do is you introduce yourself, tell us what you write, and tell us what the first print run's going to be. And I went, oh, no. So the non-fiction writer said, oh, you know, I'm so-and-so, and the print run's about 3,000 if you're lucky. If it's really popular, they'll go on. And the contemporary fiction writer said, oh, look, you know, maybe 1,000, unless you've got a proven record, and et cetera, et cetera. The poet said, oh, maybe a couple of hundred. And they got to me and I said, maybe about 10,000. And that's when I knew I was in, because I said, you go! Fantastic! And by the end of the time I was there, we had the non-fiction writer was writing about poison, and she had these literary poisons and historical poisons, and she inserted a little fantasy thing, where she imagined how it might have been different, like how you would have saved the person. So she said, I'm writing fantasy. And the poet was writing fantasy and I was writing poetry, and we were just... I write terrible poetry. That's a good reason why she's a poet, not me. And so that was quite cathartic, because it's so validating going to a place like that and having other writers going, no, actually, you're good at this. And you can stand up amongst these other people that you formerly thought you wouldn't fit in amongst. While I was there, the Sydney Writers' Festival was on. And my agent came up from Melbourne and said, come down, meet me. I had to go talk to the publisher at HarperCollins. In fact, I need to backtrack, because I haven't explained how I got the agent. You know, I said Dirk Strasser did Aurealis magazine, and he's a man who likes to get his fingers in a lot of pies, usually at the detriment of his own writing, unfortunately, because he kept doing all these other things. He starts the Aurealis Awards, and he also thought, all right, there's not many agents out there who can understand science fiction and fantasy. That could be a good career move. I might be able to give up my day job and do this for a living. And we both actually had this rather traumatic experience, because he took on my book. I said, yeah, sure, I don't mind having an agent, that's going to make things easier. He sent it off to a certain publisher who will not be mentioned, who basically hung on to it for 2 years. And she kept telling us that she would muck up the work and send it back, and don't worry, we're just waiting for the right slot, and blah, 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 blah. And she was lying through her teeth. And I found out later what her real agenda was, and she was just holding my stuff aside just in case what she really wanted to publish didn't happen. So I tell the writers now, do not leave your work with a publisher for 2 years. That's just unreasonable. By the end of that, Dirk didn't want to be an agent anymore. You know, it completely put him off, which is really sad, because Australia needs more agents, and it particularly needs more agents who understand science fiction and fantasy. So back to Lonely Planet. I was doing a commission job at Lonely Planet, and Lonely Planet at that point had changed quite a bit. It wasn't quite so laid back and hippie, and it used to be we had this tradition where a new person came along and you'd take them under your wing and you'd take them into the cafe and you'd show them where all the facilities are, and they weren't doing that anymore. This editor started, and I was watching her, just people were just ignoring her. They weren't even talking to her. So I followed her into the kitchen one day. I said, hi, what's your name? Julia, you know, chatting away. I said, where'd you work before this? Oh, I used to work for Pam McMillan, she said. Oh, okay. And all of a sudden we're doing this whole reminisce of how Pam McMillan started the first fantasy imprint and all the sorts of books that they published, and how it was sad that, you know, some like Dirk Strasser didn't get his second book written very fast, so they never ended up publishing the third book of his series, which is really quite sad, because it's a really good book. I've read it. And then she said to me, well, how do you know all this stuff? I said, I work for Aurealis magazine and I also write. She said, oh, you write, dear. Oh, can I read your manuscript? And I was just like, most editors, if you say you're a writer, they go, get away from you, dear man. And I went, okay. So I gave her a printout. She took it home, and then she came back a week or so later and said, I hope you don't mind, but I've sent it off to my friend, the agent. The agent, Fran Bryson. And I said, no, I don't mind at all. Thanks to my friends ringing me saying, can I read the next one? So that's how I got my agents. Like, always pays to be nice to people where you work. You never know what connection there's going to be. So Fran said, yep, HarperCollins is the one. Yeah, they've got this new big imprint. Voyager was quite new then. Yeah, said a couple of, I think Jenny Fallon was in the list, but I was between Jenny Fallon and like Glenda Larkin and Russell Kirkpatrick. So I go down to Sydney Writers Festival, and everyone's already drunk. It's only about 11 o'clock in the morning, and everyone's already drunk. I'm going, oh, so what they say about Writers Festivals is true. And so at one point, Linda leans over to me and she says to me, so tell me about your book. And I just got into such a phase of explaining it in worthy terms to these people at Varuna. You know, it was based on a society that developed with magic and you know, and there's no gunpowder, because why would you bother inventing guns if you had this powerful magic? And all this sort of kind of worthy way of describing it. And she went, looked at Fran and said, it's good, isn't it? And I swear, you know, I had no idea about pitch. doing a pitch. And I would have killed, you know, I would have killed my chances of being published if it wasn't for Fran at that point. And she saved my life. She said, of course it's good. And I thought, okay, well, she wanted the da-da-da-da, excitement, romance, but kind of pitch. And I just, had no clue at that point. So, advice to writers, make sure you've got a really killer pitch. So, Linda did take on the books, and suddenly I was a published author. Some of the things I don't tell you about being a published author, which I swear I should do a workshop on what to do after you sign the contract. Now, of course, I'm an illustrator, so I've done my own covers for the books. This is book one and book two, The Magician's Guild and The Novice. And that painting on the right-hand left, I got so fussy with it, and I thought, those little bricks. It took me a year to paint that. It was all between other jobs and things. I got so tired of painting bricks. Bricks and tiles. But they, when I showed them to them, I said, they are fantastic, they're wonderful, absolutely great, but we're not going to use them because we have a policy of never using artwork by the author, the author's relatives, the author's spouse, the author's associates, anyone the author knows. And I said, that's a bit difficult to use because I commission artwork for ILS magazine, so I know all of the illustrators in Australia. And she went, I know you'll find one. Okay. So I got onto a website, I think, called Dreamscape. It's based in Queensland, and they often come to cons and sell posters and things. And they had a section on their website of new Australian illustrators, and there was a fantastic picture there, nice and dark, and not so much sort of glittering unicorns, which is not going to match my sort of book that I do. And I thought, Les Peterson, I'll see what he's... I looked at his site, I looked at the other work that he'd done. I thought, okay, so I'll suggest him. And so they went, yeah, we like it. We'll commission him. So I actually got Les Peterson his first job, his first, obviously illustration job. He loved me. He really loved me. We had to dinner. And the best thing was we got to collaborate quite a bit because we both spoke the same language. And he did that. He did the first book off his own bat. He came up with the idea. And then I said, oh, let's follow that pattern. I show you the first book. That you've got two figures and then an archway and building the background. And so, you can see that. I said, all right, well, why don't you do this arena and a hedge archway. And then the third one would be going into the... In this series, there's a little old building that's encased in a great big graceful hall. So it's like the original building the guild was in. And they just hollowed it out and made a big sort of hall for meetings and stuff. And built a great big hall around it. And then there's the university. It's this great big building that's built over it. So it's sort of the sense of the older time and new time. So, he did pretty much what I suggested and got the characters looking. I the little nerd that I am, I actually had done pattern making, and so I did the top half of the novice uniform, and I took photos of my friends in it and sent them to him, and it's really good. So when the US came to take up the book, they decided they were going to do the same thing, but with some changes. That was the cover for the second book. And I emailed back to him and said, there's a dragon on the cover. There are no dragons in the book. And I said, we think it will sell. And I said, it's the second book. The only thing that sells the second book, aside from not having an absolutely horrible cover that makes you want to back away and scream, is the first book. If you like the first book, you buy the second book. You don't really pay that much attention to the cover. And I said, okay. I said, the other thing is that dragon-loving people will read this book and hate me because there's no dragons in it.
Yes, they'll get very annoyed.
Yeah. And I said, what about a griffin?
Running
out of time. I said, I'm not going to get away with not having some sort of magical beastie, am I? So I said, well, at least there's horses in the book. Let's just do a winged horse. And not a glittery unicorn-y horse. Make it a demon-winged horse so it's nice and dark. So that's I don't know why. The other thing I hate about these covers is the fact that Akron has a mullet. In fact, Sally has a mullet too. What is it with their hairstyle? I really don't know. And they're fighting their friend in that last one. But, it got people in. They bought it. The UK covers. They are beautiful. They really are. And the best thing about the UK covers is when the foreign editions come along, they often buy the rights to use them as well. The funniest, some of them are quite different, like the bottom left-hand corner one, it's the Dutch one. And every now and then I get someone emails and they say, well, why have you got the same cover as such and such? Or apparently other publishing companies, like small foreign language ones, they'll only buy it for their region. So you know, if the German book has that cover, then someone in the Dutch area can just go, oh, well, I can buy the market, that market, so I can put it on a different book. I love the way the French one, which is it's a very elaborate version of the UK one. It's the Indonesian one, which is the orange, the second one. If you look really closely, they've commandeered all those little figures and put them in the background. And I mostly wonder if they actually paid for the rights. In 2005, Orbitz UK decided to re-release them as hardback young readers editions. And Paul and I went over there for Glasgow, and they said, oh, we'll have dinner and we'll do some publicity stuff. And I'm like, oh, okay. So we have dinner, we have lunch, and they start telling me about how they've got a TV ad, they've got posters in the underground coming up, they've got all this stuff, and I spent most of the time with my jaw on the floor of the cafe going, wow, you have a budget, you know. And they took me out to the warehouse where I sat.
You're not leaving till you eat them all.
Where I signed 1,000 books in 3 hours. Now, when they were taking me around bookshops and getting me to sign stock, I bumped into this little nervous-looking guy, you know, Chris Ryan, who's a military thriller writer, and he says, oh, did they take you out to the warehouse? And I said, yeah, he's at Coventry. It's so lovely, isn't it? So I didn't even get a chance to see it. He said, how long did you stay there? Oh, 2-3 days, or something like that. And I said, how many books did you sign? Oh, about 5,000, something like that. My God, you're looking at his hands, it's still attached. And then my publicity officer nudged me in the ribs, and she's really quite funny. She said, next time you come to the UK, we'll send you on a real tour. I'm really scared. I never actually saw it myself. They sent me a photo of the poster in the address.
Oh, that's cool.
And then that's the second series. Now, fun cover story this way was with the US ones, which are in the centre there. The one on the left is what they sent me for the first book. Well, it's absolutely perfect for the third book, because the character at one stage is at a waterfall and she's kind of like, her stature is not what it was, but she's become more relaxed sort of person. So it's so obviously the third book. So I got back to them and said, I don't suppose you can do a new one for the first one, because that is so ideal for the third book. So they did. They were really good. They followed my instructions and make her more austere. And then they did the second book. Now, don't ask me why the peace-loving Dreamweaver is wielding a sword. But, yeah. And when I pointed that out to them, I said, can you just change it to a knife or something? You know, maybe I could make it the healer's knife or something. And they said, no, we've used up our favours with the marketing department. But still, it's loads better than the first series was in There's No Dragons and Winged Horses. In the UK, they are always on the back of a bus. Then this is my agent and her assistant and me, and that's our celebratory Moe Chandon package that Orbitz sent after they persuaded me to accept their £1 million contract. Grinning up there.
Ooh, strawberries and watch on
it. Yeah, they went very well with the champagne, I must say.
One bottle each?
Yeah. When I came to, I did a proposal for the next series, I remember starting with something like, the readers loved the first series and they sold really well, so they're going to get more of the same. Yeah. I wasn't necessarily thinking brutally that way. I just had all these stories and I was so excited and saying, the readers are going to love this. And the publishers are going, we like that too. So Fran said, well, let's just do something different. Instead of sending it to Australia first and get that contract and go to the overseas and do them all separately, let's just see if the two publishing companies, because I was HarperCollins in Australia and the US, and I was Orbit in the UK, let's just see what they'll do with worldwide rights. And then, a couple of days go past, and I get this phone call at midnight saying, and I ignored it the first time around because I wake up very slowly. And the second time around, I had to ring it the second time because you have to. Are you sitting down? And I said, oh, must be good news then. And she said, how about the £1 million? So I'm sitting down now. But it actually took a while to get to that point because there was a bit of toing and froing and auctioning and stuff. And even while it was really exciting, it was actually excruciating because I'd come to love working with all the people of both companies. And you knew that you were going to have to say goodbye and not work with people that you really love. I mean, I love Stephanie Smith at HarperCollins. She's fantastic. And so, yeah, it was also quite sad at the same time. But ultimately, I think you can see why I chose Orbit. Their publicity, the covers are fantastic. Their publicity was really on the ball. And then when they told me they were going to start the first worldwide imprint, which is Orbit, of science fiction and fantasy, I'm like, okay. yeah, just send me three bottles of champagne and a magnum of Moët Chandon. I'll go, okay. But yeah, I still really miss working with the HarperCollins team, but I love working with the Orbit people because they're good too. So yeah, then I wrote the first book, which is the one that's out at the moment, The Magician's Apprentice. It was launched in Brisbane at the Aurelius Awards, and there it is. So, has anyone got any questions?
You've kind of answered them all, right?
Yeah.
I got very practiced at this. I got very practiced. But I know there's some things there I left out, so I guess.
Was there a reason the fact that, I've forgotten who it was, didn't want to use the author's illustrations? Did they think authors can't draw or?
I think it's got more to do with making your chances of things running smoothly better. Mm-hmm. An author, I was saying I'm a professional illustrator, I will change things, I'm quite flexible, you know, I've done this before, but on the other hand, I'd never done before, really. But it really comes down to I'd never tried to do an illustration for my own book for a publishing company. And who knows, I might have got to a point where I went, this is horrible, they want me to change this, they want me to put a dragon on the cover, I can't do it. So I think this probably is that just that there's a safety in the separation. That it means less is less lucky or problem.
I find that you draw people like huge descriptions in your book of the characters of the physical, and yet I've got a very, very personal vision. Everybody's got a thing. Do you set out to do that deliberately, or has it?
It's something I learned. That if you suggest just the merest, you know, Sonia is a short person with short hair.
Yeah.
She's quite diminutive for her size. Yeah. A lot of people say she whacks a small... She's a bit small package, but she whacks a lot of magic.
Yeah, yeah.
I sort of learned that if you let people fill in their own details, they'll actually stick better
yeah. Mm-hmm.
than if you tell them that they've got, you know, woman hair that curls at the end. You know, blue eyes, but with a slight flick of
hair. And that's all you ever see about it, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I like people to fill in. And I'm the same when it comes to pronunciations. People will say to me, how do you pronounce this, that and the other? I said, however you want. Because a few times I've actually said, well, I pronounce it like this, they go, oh, that's not what I do. And you know, they go straight back to what they do. And that's fine with me. I think that's really nice. I like the way people interpret to an extent.
That's good.
Books. If you had a chance for your books to be adapted, who would you pick to do these things like?
I know, I used to say George Lucas, but after that... I was really keen for Peter Jackson when the first Lord of the Rings movie came out, but I think by the end he was getting a little bit carried away. Tim Burton, maybe? Oh, yeah, so you've got to have something a bit dark, I think. But I've always actually thought that I'd love to see it as a Japanese animation. I really think it would be. And I must admit, I was reading a lot of Japanese animation at the time when I was writing it, and that probably, you know, there's little subtle sort of Japanese touches like the paper screens and stuff like that in there for a sense of the world. Ooh, simultaneous, so go to the side first.
Considering other international guests sitting here then, has gone from hard sci-fi to fantasy, would you consider going from fantasy to more of a hard sci-fi?
No, I'm not really interested in science fiction that much, but I might go horror. In fact, I've got an idea for a young adult horror novel that I'd love to do.
Okay.
I was reading Princess of the White, and the princess's companion mischief. Where did he come from? He's adorable.
Ooh, I must say, at the time I'd actually repossessed is a strange word, my cat. So I know that influenced things as well, but... Tennis Lee does a book called The Black Unicorn, and there's a few other follow-ups. Mm. And what I love, I never really liked the idea of, you know, the beaver coming up to you and going, would you like a cup of tea? I prefer the, you know, if a talking animal's going to talk, it should talk like an animal would talk. And she has these peeves, a made-up creature that, you know, runs around going, boom, boom, dig, 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 boom, you know. And I thought, I'll do something like that, but I'll also make it, they were telepathic. So eventually she gets like, boom, 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 you know, in her head as well. I had so much fun with that one. Yeah. Gone. Okay.
Wow. Oh. I think so. Can you talk more about the Edge of Crime series and how that developed?
Well, it it's a story that's far, far older than the Black Magician trilogy. I started writing it when I was 14, and when I decided that having had two unsuccessful attempts that get rejected, the first series, that I needed to write something more sort of, I suppose, mainstream fantasy, something with, you know, with a quest and something with continents and gods and more the less the sort of subtle, wet and dark, more the sort of grand quest fantasy. So I went back and I found this story and I went, actually, that's not bad for a 14-year-old. I'll just have to take out the miniature winged unicorns. And I'll have to take out the bad prince who had the leather that creaked all the time. I'm sorry. But the other thing too was that when I actually came to write it, because I had wrote about six chapters and then the other books got published, and so I sort of had to put that aside and polish those books, etc. When I went back to start writing it, I'd been to one of my agent's parties, and I was quite drunk, which happens a lot at my agent's parties. And someone leaned over and said, "Tell us about your books." And I went, "Fran, you explain. You're my agent." She went, "They're fantasy books for young readers." And I went, "No, they're not." Because I never intended them to be young adult books. I always intended them to be, you know, broad, like young adults could read them, but not specifically young adult books. So I went, "Damn it, next time I write a book, it's going to be an adult book." When I came to write, I thought, okay, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? How am I going to make this so that teenagers can't read it? And I thought, okay, sex, drugs and... not rock and roll, sex, drugs and violence. And I thought, violence, well, how violent would you have to be these days for it to be not suitable for teenagers? I mean, come on. And drugs, I mean, I don't want to write an issues book. You know, you don't want to be in danger of being preachy. You know, it's sex. All right! And there's not that much in it. And when parents say to me, you know, my young child likes your first series, but I've heard your second series might not be suitable, you know, what do you say to that? I said, well, just go read chapter 20 of the first book, and it has a prostitute having sex with a client. I thought, okay, if that's too much, then that's too much. That's the decision point. But, yeah, that was fun.
Because a lot of people find it all as good, I mean, read all their books, have you been attacked by any court police for young people reading your first series and therefore reading your second series and actually reading about sex?
No. I think if they have, so I don't think the first series necessarily goes very young, and I think there's not a lot in that second series. They probably went, I got away with reading this, my parents don't know. They're not going to complain. And I also, you know, I've occasionally heard about a bookshop somewhere that's got the second series in the children's section. I'll contact them and say, you probably shouldn't do that. But I haven't actually had any flack. So, if anything, I've had flack for writing something that's quite different. Because some people really think I should write the same thing over and over and over again. And a lot of writers do that, and I don't want to be one of those people.
Don't be John Saul.
Anymore?
Okay, in that case, we'll let the room of the Empire go start going. But thank you very much, Teresa.
Thank you.